Hello again, welcome to another edition of On Mic with Jordan Rich. I would be he, and it's so nice to welcome you, where we sit around and talk with people in the performing arts about what they do, why they do it, and share great stories about their experiences. Today, I'm having a chat with special effects man Gary King, who comes from a family of creative Hollywood types who have collectively worked on dozens of hit motion pictures and top-ranking TV shows. Gary became a regular panel member on my late-night WBZ radio show, and he was such an incredible asset, informing us so brilliantly about the making of film. So, I invite you to settle back and enjoy my latest conversation, a peek behind the curtains, with special effects master Gary King. I can't tell you how excited I am to have you here, Gary, because you and I go back a long way on terrestrial radio.
It goes both ways, Jordan.
We have been friends for a long time. This gentleman is truly a gentleman, Gary King, living in Massachusetts. But for many, many years, actually many decades, you spent time in Hollywood and beyond as a special effects master. And we could spend hours talking about your background and your career. But
I was an apprentice.
But you were actually doing this before all the computer stuff started to happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right. So take us on a little journey. Your first project is a little-known comedy.
Sort of.
And actually, back up a little bit. I'm asking you to do this for us first and talk about your family involvement.
Oh, well, I'm one of four boys. I'm in the middle. My two older brothers had the opportunity to work with my father at 20th Century Fox Studios. My mother was in the wardrobe department for the Civic Light Opera, Los Angeles, Long Beach, Pasadena. Mm-hmm. Any of the when Disney Ice came out, Disney on Ice,
sure.
She was the first wardrobe lady to do their shows in L.A.
Okay.
And so she got me a job when I got out of high school going into college. She got me a job for two shows with her. So I was in the wardrobe department.
Now, your dad, let's not skip over what he did, because he worked on some iconic shows.
Oh, one of my favorites. My father was in the studio business probably from the middle 1950s. He also did live stage theater for a while. Mm-hmm. But he did, what was it? It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World. And I remember going to the location towards the end of the movie when they're on this fire truck.
Famous scene.
And they're down at the bottom of a hill in Santa Monica, right at Santa Monica Beach. And I remember spending the day there watching these guys rig this fully extended ladder, and the characters are on it swinging, supposed to be them, swinging around, and how it's they go flying off of it. And, I just loved that show. And to see my father working on that and to be there with him was really, it's like your son getting to work with you.
Oh, absolutely. It's a thrill. And your dad also worked on some television series, I believe.
He did, worked on Bonanza. He worked on, what's it, Lucy, the Lucy Show. I don't think it was I Love Lucy.
One of the Lucy.
It was, I know one when versions. They were doing a snow scene. They were caught in this cabin.
Uh-huh.
And they, with Fred and Ethel.
Oh, yeah.
And they were caught in this cabin, and they figured they had to get out, and they open up the door, and it's full of snow. So they're inside, and as this door opens, here comes this, it was a band, you know, Oompa-Pa band.
Okay. Came,
and it rescued them.
Oh, that's hysterical. But and your
did
dad
the snow scene on it.
Was doing props and special effects way back then.
Yeah, they also did, he was building sets, and then they got into the what they call the action prop miniature shop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they build, they could build a car that would drive backwards. We spun the driver inside around. They had the Ghost and Mrs. Muir. They had this beautiful, beautiful Rolls Royce that they made the driver sit in the trunk of the car and act like it was being driven by a ghost.
Right.
All the different gags that he worked, Land of the Giants, Lost in Space, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
So as a kid, as a young guy, you were privy to what dad was doing, because sometimes dad would bring his son to the office, and what a thrill. So it's a natural development for you to sort of get into the business.
Oh, absolutely. I remember my dad coming home from a show, and he had all my brothers and I together, and he says, "Guys, you will not believe what they're paying me to do." And he says, "You've got to check it out." So During the summers, we had our time. He'd say, okay, Gary, you want to go to the studios today? Sure, Pop. So we'd head off to work. And once we got into the studios, he would say, okay, I've got to go do this job today. I want you to meet so-and-so. I want you to meet this guy and this guy. He's working on a job over on stage 14. When you get tired of being there, call on the phone for a driver. They'll take you from there to any other stage you want to go. So that's what I did for the day.
Immersed in this imaginary playroom.
Yep, lost in space.
Oh, my gosh.
Land of the Giants.
And yeah. When you're on a set like that, in terms of the construction and the background, are you able to be part of the actual action? Do you see the filming of these programs? Do you see the actors?
Yeah, you do. I mean, it's just a big sound stage, and everybody's in there doing their part.
Mm-hmm.
You see the sound mixer doing his thing. You see the director doing his thing. The focus puller doing his thing. The boom man doing his thing. The lighting guy's up above.
It's a team effort.
It's
no
a
question.
Whole team effort.
So I teased this a little bit, and I suggested the first full-length project you worked on was a little film, a little-known film called Young Frankenstein. And tell the story, because there was another movie you might have worked on, right?
Oh, of course. It was at that time I had been trying to get into the studios for about 3 years. I'd go to every studio lot, sign an application to become a prop maker.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever they got to the point that they had a big construction job and the union didn't have enough guys to call to go out and do this job, they would call the permit list, and I was on this permit list. So I was able to, I had to wait 3 years, and I was a chainsaw mechanic for McCulloch Chainsaws. And I had been there for about 3 or 4 years, and my dad called me one afternoon, and he says, Gary, I've got a job for you. Actually, I got two jobs for you. And I'm going, what is it, Pop? He says, well, you can either work with Roy Arbogast, who had worked in his shops with him for a few years. He says, he's building these giant sharks. And they're making them out of with hydraulic lines, and they're doing foam application skins. And he says, you'd be perfect. I was certified scuba. He said, they're going to take this and do some underwater work, so you'd work fine in it. But to take that job, I'd have to drive about 30 miles from where I lived. And I said, oh, that sounds great. And he says, well, here's the other chance. He says, I've got a job at Fox Studios to do. He says, a lot of gags on it. He says, you can start out as a prop maker building the sets. I said, okay, what's that? He says, well, it's a show called Young Frankenstein. And he says, we're starting, this was on a Friday when he called me, he says, we're starting Monday morning. I said, what time, Pop? He says, we'll start at 6. He says, be there about 5. So I did. I showed up at 5.
Wow.
And the first thing they did, my dad gave me a roll-around little toolbox that he had built. All of the carpenters on the studio lots had these little pull-around flip-top boxes that they had built with handsaws and hammers and screwdrivers. And he said, take my box, because my dad was running the action prop miniature shop at the time. He didn't need that toolbox anymore. Mm-hmm. All he needed was his finger to point and say, okay, you go here. So he said, get on this truck, and they'll take you to the set. And first thing, we went to one of the biggest sound stages at Fox Studios and started flooring the wall, the floors.
Right.
Put all brand new plywood on the floors. And next thing you know, we're framing these walls.
Creating, by the way, the famous castle and
exterior.
The laboratory. And
yeah,
all
it was the
things.
Exterior and the interior. Mm. And this soundstage had to be 60, 70 feet tall, so the walls could be at least 40 feet tall.
I heard that Mel Brooks actually was able to utilize some of the original set pieces from Frankenstein.
Yeah, the laboratory.
He? Right, right.
All of the what I would call the bells and whistles.
So that stuff must have been in some...
They have a prop house.
Prop house?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Every studio lot, MGM, Warner Brothers, Fox, Universal, Paramount, they all have their storage.
God, that must be fun. That must be fun to hang out in
those
places. They
pull out walls and everything from any of the old shows if they keep them.
Wow.
They say, go ahead, we need this.
So you keep mentioning gags.
Yeah.
I love that inside baseball talk.
Yeah.
Gags, meaning bits that we see on screen, things that we see that make us laugh or make us scream in terror.
Yeah.
These are called gags.
Yeah.
Give us an example of, and I hope you do the one that I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
In Young Frankenstein, that's a big gag that you worked on.
My dad says, Gary, you're going to work with Ralphie Winiger. Ralphie was probably one of the smartest and most versatile workers that my dad had ever gotten to work with. And he, in turn, turned me on to him. He says, follow Ralphie. Now, Ralphie and I are both about the same size. And he had a son and he had a daughter, and they were both in the business, too. Ralphie says, Gary, we've got a little project. He says, it's going to make, we have to build a bookcase. I said, okay. So that's what we did. We built this bookcase. And he says, now we're going to put it on top of a round table, sink the round table down in the floor, and we're going to make it spin.
Yep.
He says, you don't want to spin it fast because the guy's going to get caught in it.
He says, oh, he is. Dr. Frankenstein, I presume. This is, by the way, one of my favorite. I mean, a lot of people love the movie, but as scenes go, there's so many quotable ones. This is one of my favorites. So you helped build that famous prop piece.
Yeah, I took pictures of all the gags that I worked on. I always tried to have a camera with me. At that time, it was a little Polaroid that my dad had given to me. So I had Polaroid cameras.
There's so many things, Gary, that in that era are special. Actually, that era and 20, 30, 40 years previous.
Yeah.
Because, as I say, it was not computer-generated stuff. It was handmade and creative.
Physically shot.
And so creatively designed by people.
And that was the thing towards, I would say, in the later 80s, the head of our special effects shop and prop shop said, you know, guys, there's this new thing called a computer graphic, CGI. He says, and within a few years, we won't need the special effects guys anymore.
Mm.
And we're all looking at each other going, you got to be kidding us. And he says, yeah. He says, you know, the explosions, the bullet hits, the car crashes, it's all going to be computer generated. He says, I don't know what that means right now, but this is what it's going to go.
It's so interesting. Gary and I, as I mentioned in the introduction, Gary was a panel member of our movie crew on WBZ CBS Radio, and we used to talk about this stuff ad nauseum. But nowadays, there are a few directors, who's the guy that did Mad Max? There are a few directors who actually go back and want to shoot the real old-fashioned way.
Yeah.
And I think that's dynamite. And, you know, whether it's a fight scene or a chase scene or any kind of gag.
Look at that dog show claymation they just did.
Oh, yeah. That's old school technology.
Yeah, that is certainly old school. And it costs just as much, I think, if not more, than doing CGI.
Gary, there are so many things that
an
expert in special effects and a prop master would do.
Mm-hmm.
And you just sort of mentioned this in passing, but let's get into it. And I don't mean to be maudlin here, but gunfights, bullet wounds, blood splatter, breakaways, things like that. The standard Hollywood fare. Talk a little bit about that stuff.
The shop that my dad was head of was called the Action Prop Miniature Shop at 20th Century Fox Studios. And his shop would build a lot of the gags. They would build the breakaway furniture, the breakaway windows, the cars that would flip over and blow up, the flying rigging gags, like Peter Pan type of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So they would, my dad would say, okay, here's a chair, like a captain's chair, all wood. I need 10 of these made up out of balsa wood. So I learned how to use the wood lathe. So I was able to take a piece of wood and turn it down into the spindles and the seat and all that. And he says, okay, now I want you to, he really liked the first one I made. So he says, now make 10 more. And I'd get into making 10 more. And also he'd say, well, we actually need another 10 after that. So I had all of the pieces cut, everything I needed. We'd put these chairs together with hot glue, which was a new thing at the time. And we would take them onto a set and there'd be a bar scene. We'd have to make, for special effects, we'd have to make the smoke atmosphere. Like everybody's got their cigars and, you know, old stogies. And they'd have a guy up in the stairway and They start fighting, and he breaks through the railing, down on the table.
You know, it comes to mind the fight scene in The Great Race in the mid-60s Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis. But, I mean, there's so many examples.
The pie scenes.
Yeah, oh, gosh. But those breakaway pieces and all that, they're all part of the magic of movie.
Majority of them were made out of either a real high-density foam, or majority of time they would be balsa wood.
Mm-hmm.
And balsa wood is a strange material. It's almost like a cork, but there's a male and a female balsa wood.
Really?
If you use the male balsa wood, it's like getting hit with a piece of oak.
Oh, my goodness.
If you use female balsa wood, it's like getting hit with a piece of sponge.
Oh, my goodness. I'll take the female if
I I don't.
The blood?
Blood gags.
Gags. Yeah. And they're called gags, but I mean, I remember when movies in the 30s and 40s, you'd see somebody get shot, a gangster, and no blood, nothing. It was just assumed.
He'd grab his heart and
it. But then in the 60s, when it became more realistic, mm-hmm. things changed. But is that a process that was developed during the 50s and 60s, or do you know much about that?
I would say, it probably came more into the 60s. Some of the violent scenes, they started shooting high speed. They wanted to see the actor get hit and blood splatter and hit the walls. Mm. And it was like, remember, on The Birds. Getting attacked, and they want to see
some
blood
of those
splatter.
Early examples of that. Sam Peckinpah's films in the early 60s.
So those blood bags were something that the special effects guys had to figure out the best way to rig them so that the actor wouldn't get hurt, but it looked like he had a hole blown through him. And I worked with, 100 different special effects guys, and each one had their own special way of rigging the blood bag hit. One of the toughest ones, I think, was we did a show called The Final Countdown.
Oh, yes, with Burt Lancaster.
Yeah, it was Michael Douglas.
Douglas. You're right.
And his dad.
You're right.
It was Michael Douglas and his dad.
Kirk Douglas.
And his brother directed the show.
Okay.
Or produced it. His brother produced it. Anyway, we had to do a bullet hit on it was a Japanese pilot that had gotten shot down. And they had him in his flight suit. And we were on the aircraft carrier Nimitz back in Norfolk, Virginia, shooting it. And I remember the effects guy running the show said, Gary, we've got to rig this guy with as many blood hits as we can find from head to toe. And I think in that flight suit, the front of it and the back of it, we had like what they call an in and out. So when the front shot went off, the back shot would go off, just all wiring inside. And I think I rigged probably 50 blood bags on this suit. It almost looked like the guy had 50 pounds of weight hanging all around him.
Not a good day for the character, I assume.
No.
Okay.
And the actor, very famous Japanese actor, wasn't Mitsui Mufuni.
Okay.
But it was something, needless to say, the actor said, what's this going to feel like? And I said, well, you want to hold your breath and prepare to get hit. And I tapped him on his chest with my knuckle, and I said, that's kind of what you're going to feel, but you're going to feel it twice as much.
We're talking about special effects and the magic of the movies with Gary King, who for decades has been doing it, his whole family. In fact, your brothers are still – one of your brothers or both?
Jay just retired. My youngest brother just retired after 44 years.
And your other brother?
My two older brothers, Robert, Bob, and Bill – both retired a number of years ago. Bill was a prop master.
We used to speak. Was it Jay we spoke with
Jay
on the
called
air?
In and my brother Bill called in.
From The Life of Pi and various other big movies.
He did the Batman shows. He did the Spider-Man shows. He did the Pirates of the Caribbean.
So he was one who sort of traversed the decades and was working in the old school and the new school?
Yes, combined.
Combined, wow.
And Jay had, I'd say it was 44 years. He started with me on Towering Inferno.
Which is what I wanted to come to next.
Oh, good.
As a huge fan of the disaster movies, this was this Irwin Allen's
movie? That was Irwin Allen. Yeah.
And he was famous.
He was contracted at Fox.
For that.
Yeah.
That involved a lot of water and a lot of rigging, right?
Massive.
It's an amazing film even today when you look back.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember the scene when Fred Astaire is strapping himself in.
Yeah, against the plywood.
Against the plywood.
Yeah.
So what
against
was your,
against a pillar.
Yeah, what was your role in that film?
At that time, that was a big restaurant scene. And again, it was on the same soundstage that we did Young Frankenstein. Huge, huge. Mm. We had built an overhead rigging of pipes, pivoting down and spraying water everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a reaction of the water dropping, you know, thousands of gallons up in the top of the building, dropping down 30 feet, 40 feet, and hitting the floor and then splashing. And the actors were supposed to be getting hit by this wave of water hitting the ground. Paul Newman, Steve McQueen,
right,
and Fred Astaire.
Right.
Even O.J. Simpson.
Oh, he was in it too.
He was a bartender.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember Robert Wagner was in the film.
Yeah, RJ.
And,
yeah.
And William Holden.
Yeah.
It was truly an all-star cast.
Yeah, it was unbelievable cast. And that stage rigging was
so would that have been a one-shot take, hopefully?
Well,
or did
that was
work
the master shot, yes.
Okay.
But as any production goes, you have a master shot shooting all of the characters in frame. And then the next would be a two-take or a three-take, which would be two people in front of the camera lens or three people or five. And then they would do over the shoulder of each mm-hmm. person, mm-hmm. going through their lines.
Which
all
is why movies take so long and they're so arduous.
It takes
so
12
expensive.
Hours to shoot, let's say, 12 minutes of
right.
work.
You know, yep. in your career, which mm-hmm. was amazing, you were working on such projects as Young Frankenstein
yep.
and the aforementioned Towering Inferno. But
yes.
you also worked in television on probably the greatest sitcom of its time, MASH.
MASH.
How about that?
MASH was, that was the longest running at the time. That was 11 years.
Yeah.
And I got to work on it, oh, maybe every couple weeks with Fred Kramer, who was the special effects guy on the show. And he would hire my brothers and I to help him make all the smoke come out of the tents, the mm-hmm. smokestacks, or to do dust flying when the helicopter would land and they'd
right.
rush in, or ground explosions. They had a scene called POV, Point of View,
mm-hmm.
and it was about a soldier that got hit by a ground explosion. And it was his point of view looking at mm. the other rescue hospital personnel taking him into the operating room or into the recovery and in his bed and saying, "How you doing?" He was blinded, but he trying to think, think he gained consciousness and then started listening and finally started seeing everybody. And that was POV. It was an award winner.
When you're working,
great show.
I'm just curious, when you're working on any of these projects, I know you were a younger mm-hmm. guy then, we all were, but
yeah.
are you thinking, wow, this is a pretty cool project. I wonder if 30 years from now or 40 years from now, this will stand the test of time. Does any of that filter in when you're doing something?
I can see a lot of remakes
yeah.
Based on a lot of the shows, the earlier shows.
There's been nothing like MASH since.
No.
I mean, it just stands alone.
MASH, when that was running, I probably, like I say, I probably worked on it out of 11 years. I probably worked maybe 9 or 10 years.
Mm.
My brother Jay worked through the whole thing. He finished with that one.
Is that unusual, by the way, for a crew to be together for that many years on a project? Or are there more gypsies in and out of crews like that?
You usually will have maybe the same group of directors. They might have four or five directors.
Okay.
They might have the same sound mixer, the same camera operator, first camera unit crew, the gaffer who heads up the lighting and rigging. The grips, some of the key personnel will stay with the show, okay. the producers and the writers.
Sure.
You know, but the rest of the crew, if it depends on when they have an off season, let's say it's about 2 or 3 months, they shut down, people go out and they get other jobs and they get locked into other mm-hmm. jobs. So now there's opening for more grips or more mm-hmm. carpenters. So those guys will come in and out for a few shows and then they're gone to something else.
Do you ever, when you see a movie or watch TV today, are you like the cobbler? Can you watch anything without saying, "I know how they did that," or "I wonder how they did that"?
No way. My wife, I swear, she will not go to a movie with me because of that. She'll sit there and whisper, "Gary, how did they do that?" And when I tell her, she says, "Oh, you shouldn't have told me."
Exactly.
How
you did it. Like a magician telling secrets.
What I figure out is how I would have done it, mm-hmm. and mistakes that I'm looking for. If I see a repeat of the show, let's say on TV, I can play it over and over again. Mm-hmm. I've recorded most of the movies that I've worked on and mm-hmm. TV shows. So I have them on VHS. And I go through those and I can say, okay, I know what we did to make this work. How did they do that one? Mm. And it's going through my mind, did they do overhead cable rigging? Now it's CGI. It's a combination, you know? So, yeah, I'm always trying to figure that stuff out.
I just read a book that was written in the 90s, and it was a biography of, more of a filmography of Charlton Heston.
Oh, yes.
And whom I adored as an actor. Chucky, right. And they were talking again about the famous chariot scene in Ben-Hur.
Yes.
Which to this day, this is 60 years ago, to this day remains one of the most impressive action sequences. When you think about it, none of it was involving computers and fancy technology. Physical rigging. And Yakima Canute's son was the special stunt coordinator.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, it's really amazing to think about that kind of ingenuity, I think is what I'm saying.
The guys that my dad introduced me to, most of them were probably in their 50s and 60s. At that time, I was 23 when I joined. And these guys were telling me, I'd ask, how'd you guys get into business? And he said, well, my dad was in it. My granddad was in it. You know, just a natural thing. They were doing the Laurel and Hardys, the Buster Keatons, the Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, my goodness.
These guys were working with these iconic actors, directors, doing their own stunts.
Right, right.
And that was, to me, was so impressive to see the 1920s, the shows how the special effects guys were working.
Buster Keaton, the scene that comes to mind is when the house falls in on around him and how dangerous that was.
He was right in the window.
Right in the window. How incredibly dangerous. Yeah. And in terms of the work you did, even in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there were some risks that actors would take. And we know about certain actors who sadly lost their lives. Brandon Lee, among others.
Due to one of them, I ended up getting my very first special effects job as a key special effects guy.
Really?
Which ran the show, was from the Twilight Zone accident.
The Vic Morrow tragedy.
Paul Stewart was a very good special effects guy, and he was key in that show. And unfortunately, it was a bad combination of mistakes that were made. From the special effects crew, for they loaded up more higher explosives after a rehearsal. The camera, the director?
John Landis.
John Landis, during this filming sequence, said he wanted the helicopter to come down lower than it had been rehearsed. Lower from, let's say, the cliff that they were against was 100 feet. When they did the rehearsal, the helicopter was, let's say, 110 feet. During the scene, Landis said, I want you down lower, come in lower. He came down below the top of the cliff, and when this explosion went off, the force of the explosion hit that wall of the cliff and went up like a chimney, like smoke up a chimney, and it engulfed and basically tore apart the control blades, the tail rotor blades. And they said debris from the explosion, like a lid from the glue that we were using to create these big fireballs, contact cement type. One of these can lids also flew up and hit one of the blades. So the blades broke apart, the helicopter collapsed and crashed, and it killed the actors on the scene. I blame John Landis for that.
Well, he went to trial over that.
He did, and he skipped out of it.
Yeah, I think so.
He was working during the trial. Yeah. And I listened to that trial. I knew the special effects guys. I got to work with them all. And I asked him, I said, what do you think? And he said, it was just a bad time.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I got the key. The show, this guy was on trial.
Interesting. Yeah, that's one of those movie moments that stands out. The Brandon Lee moment. The issue with firearms. That's another issue.
Yep.
People assume, well, they're just using blanks, but blanks can kill if they're.
How about John Eric Hexum?
Right. I remember that young, good-looking actor in a TV series.
Where he did up a and show called Cover Up.
Cover Up. Yeah. Yeah.
And I was the special effects guy standing behind the wall of the set. And I heard this gunshot go off. I knew it was a gunshot. I could hear it. And I come around the set, and I see all the camera crew and everybody. Their mouths are wide open. They're just standing there. And I see this actor leaning against the bed, headboard of the bed he was sitting on. And he had taken this blank gun and pointed it to his temple and pulled the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, we had been working so many hours throughout this new series that we were putting 12, 14 hours a day. This one particular day, we had gone through all of our setups for the day, and we were done by 3 in the afternoon, which was like breaking for lunch. So we were all getting ready to go home, and all of a sudden he says, here comes a producer, one of the line producers comes in and says, well, you guys have done so well today, we've added a few more scenes. And everybody goes, oh, no. So we knew we were going to work till 9 or 10 o'clock that night. When John Hexum heard that, he happened to have this gun in his hand, and the prop master, who was in charge of the weapons, was taking the gun from his hand because we'd done a close-up shot. And John Eric pulled the gun away from him. And he says, oh, what the blank, blank, blank. Put the gun up against his head and pulled the trigger.
As a joke?
Meaning
we have to work late? So.
As a joke.
Wow. And you were right there. So that's a traumatic moment in your life.
And I was the first person to jump up onto the bed.
Mm-hmm.
I had a set of pliers in my pockets, and I could see that his eyes were wide open. He was gasping for air, and I opened his mouth and put the pliers into his mouth to open it up.
Mm.
And I looked at his eyes, and they were glassy, and it was like he was already gone.
Mm.
And luckily, well, sort of, right across the street from that soundstage was the Century City Hospital. So instead of waiting for an ambulance to come, they took him, put him on a piece of plywood, put him in the back of a station wagon, opened up the gate, and took him straight across the street over to the hospital. So he was in the hospital within 10 minutes after the accident happened. And he was alive for about a week.
Yeah, that was a moment that remains very vivid in my mind. I wasn't
so
involved personally, but blanks do kill.
Yeah.
Well, not to end on that note, but I do want to mention the fact that your career was just amazing, and you have then moved east.
Yeah.
You now live with us on the East Coast,
which
we're thrilled about. But you're such a movie lover, and also you have an understanding of how movies are made that it's just been great getting to know you. Let me ask you if there's one particular film outside of the big ones, a smaller film that you worked on that has special memories for you.
Wow. That's a lot of shows.
I know. You did show me the picture of you with Robbie the Robot, which I think is pretty special.
That was a show, Cherry 2000.
Right.
And I use that on my Facebook. It was a futuristic show, and these Robbie the Robot and Gort.
Yes.
They were both used as props.
And Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still, the 53 version with Robert Wise directing.
And they had these two pieces set in the scene we were doing. And so I said, man, this is unbelievable. I went up and checked them out. So I told a buddy, I said, here, take my camera.
Oh.
And take some shots. I want to get a couple shots.
This is Geek City. You have to do this.
It was unbelievable. Yeah, with Melanie Griffith. And we had Ben Johnson.
Oh, gosh, the old cowboy.
The guy I went fishing with for sets. It was a futuristic job down in Nevada.
So your world took you everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, not just Hollywood, but on locations as well.
And that show had all the, you know, it was futuristic. So we had a lot of different things to do. But again, it wasn't with CGI.
Yeah.
So it worked out. It was a great show. But, yeah, that had, I think I was probably 10, 12 weeks in Nevada. Mm-hmm. And we'd moved probably 10 times to different hotels throughout the state.
So I didn't mean to plant. I didn't mean to plant the answer in your head when I brought up Robbie the Robot.
I loved it.
That was a fun experience.
Oh, absolutely! In fact, you know, Lost in Space with their robot. I remember my dad's shop built that.
The original on the TV series. Oh my God! You know how exciting that makes me. Oh,
And they had built three different models, one for doing a foot gag, just traveling. Another with just the upper part of him talking and moving around. So the actor inside of it was, I thought he was a prop man that started doing that job. And eventually that became his full-time job.
Sort of like Mr. Spinney in Big Bird. You become attached to your role.
Exactly. And every time I'd go into the shop, I'd say, oh, what's the latest? My dad said, oh, we got to fix this on the robot. We got to do this. This broke. We got to fix it.
Oh,
but
man.
Yeah, gags like that. My dad's shop specialized in Land of the Giants. They built all of the giant structures, telephones, pencils, you know, things. Lost in Space had their flying gags, the wire flying. My dad was actually contacted from NASA to take a crew of guys to Houston, in the training center for the astronauts, and they wanted them to learn how to fly by wire for their training of being in space. Because they saw the premiere of Lost in Space, which had this wire. They ended up, you know, he took a crew there for a couple weeks. They did all their riggings. It was approved. Everything was going good. And then somebody else said, hey, let's use this big swimming pool. Put everything in the water. And that's been the training ever since.
Still, your dad was absolutely impressive in not all that work that was on screen became. I was only like 10 years old, 8 years old at the time, and I was enthralled. Yeah. It looked real to me.
When we saw my dad would bring the script home, you know, and my brothers and I would get to read the scripts. Yeah. So we followed the shows every time. And that was one thing. Batman, when that was on, same thing.
Oh, gosh.
We read all the scripts.
Now, you mentioned you have a Facebook page. What is it? Simply your name?
Or? It's just, it's Gary King.
All right, Gary King.
Special effects. I'm on imdb.com mm-hmm. under Gary L. King Special Effects.
Excellent.
And that has sort of like a resume.
Of all the credits.
Yeah, some of them.
Yeah, there are many movies and TV shows there that people will remember.
And it's surprising. A lot of the shows will only, you know, sometimes they'll name who did the special effects. A lot of times they won't. Moonlighting, when I did that one, never showed as a special effects coordinator.
No kidding.
Never did. And
now, today, wouldn't that be absolutely important and legally it has to be done? Because if the credits roll on movies today, it takes 10 minutes.
Yeah, and what they base the credits on who's on the crew list, the last show, who's on that crew list. So Moonlighting just never did that. They just said, okay, we've got the producers, the directors, the writers, and the actors, maybe the props, maybe the wardrobe and the hairdressers, but they never showed special effects. So in IMDb, I'm listed as uncredited.
Oh, well, they don't know what they had in you. They had a
so I keep adding to it.
They had a pearl, and they didn't appreciate it. But
like I say, I'm just an apprentice.
Well, you've had an amazing career. You're still working and helping people and guiding people through life in your own special way and fixing things and building things. But I can't thank you enough for spending a little time with us here.
What
this
a
was
pleasure.
So much fun.
What a pleasure, man. Every time I get to talk to you and see you, I mean, it's like, wow. I'm talking with Jordan.
Oh, well, you've become a longtime friend. In fact, we were talking off the air about getting a reunion together and some restaurant somewhere of the movie panel we had, which was really a fine assemblage.
What a great combination. Like I introduced you to Paul Garnett.
Yes, Paul Garnett is an artist.
He's an artist.
Who mainly works in marine art, and he's brilliant.
He's he's nationally recognized in marine artists.
Right.
That's a guy that I met through another company years before, him and I have always been together. That's one thing. You introduced me to some really, really great people.
Well, the radio business is a little bit like the movie business.
Yeah.
You meet people and they become, even if you don't see them very often, they become lifelong connections and
friends.
So, Gary, thank you very much for sharing a few inside pearls here and really making the movie business seem alive and vital and exciting for us.
Well, I'm always glad to, like I say, to get a chance to chat with you. And, you know, even if it's by email, it's always a pleasure.
Well, we'll do more than that. Dinner on me. Absolutely.
Well, I like to say dinner on me, too.
Gary King, special effects master and one of the best and nicest guys in the business. Hollywood is a better place because of you. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, George. Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to On Mic with Jordan Rich, a podcast produced by Chart Productions. Just click the Jordan Rich podcast link at chartproductions.com for more. Please subscribe, download, rate, and review us on Apple and any other podcast platform. Hey, it's great to be with you as always. Thanks for listening. Have a terrific day.